නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස The first sutta that we take This is the Ambalattika Rahulovada Sutta. This is Sutta number 61 in the Middle Length Discourses, page 523. And this is called the advice, what's the word translated advice is ovada, which is something like instruction or admonition to a monk named, a novice named Rahula, at a place called the Ambalattika Grove. And who is this novice called Rahula? Rahula was the Buddha's own son, physical son. If you know the story of the Buddha, you will know that the Buddha was married to a princess whose name is given as Yasodhara. And they were married, I think, at the age of 16, according to tradition. But for 13 years, apparently, Yasodhara didn't conceive a child. But then on the very night that the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, had made the determination that he would leave the palace and take up the life of a wandering ascetic in order to seek the way to enlightenment, the way to liberation, there came, that very night when he made that determination, a messenger came to him and informed him that his wife had given birth to a baby boy. And he thought that this baby boy has now become an obstacle to my intention of renouncing the world. And so he called the baby Rahula. Apparently that is derived from the word Rahu. Rahu is conceived of as a kind of dragon or demon which swallows up the sun and the moon. It's the ancient Indian representation of the eclipse. And so Rahu is considered an obstructive force by blocking the light of the sun and the moon. And I think the name Rahula is derived from Rahu, like the offspring of Rahu. And so it comes to mean a fetter or a bond. But the Bodhisattva still continued with that determination, even though the baby child was born. And according to the traditional account, when he got up in the middle of the night, he turned and just as he was to step out the door, and he saw his wife, the Princess Yasodhara, sleeping in bed with a little child wrapped in her arms. And that gave him a very poignant feeling. On the one hand, feeling of deep attachment to his wife and his newborn son. On the other, he was very fixed in his determination to go out to leave all worldly bonds and to seek the way to enlightenment. And so, for 6 years, the Bodhisattva spent striving, struggling, undertaking the different meditations and ascetic practices, until in his 35th year, he attained enlightenment. Then sometime after, during the first year after his enlightenment, his father had heard that he was now known as the Enlightened One, and he had started teaching and acquiring a body of followers. And so his father sent messengers to him to request him to come back to pay a visit to Kapilavastu, to his home city. And so the Buddha went back to Kapilavastu, and during the course of this visit, his former wife, his former wife and the young boy who was now 7 years old for looking out and seeing the Buddha. And Rahula was so pleased by the sight of this ascetic that he said to the mother that even the shadow of this ascetic is pleasing to me. And then his mother told him, go to your father and ask him for your inheritance. Normally, for somebody in a royal family, this would mean that the father would give him wealth, treasures, position, at least the entitlement to positions of power. So when Rahula came up to the Buddha following the mother's advice and said, please, sir, give me my inheritance, the Buddha thought to himself and wondered, should I give him an inheritance of things which are impermanent, substanceless, subject to deterioration and change? Or should I give him as an inheritance what is the proper legacy of a fully enlightened Buddha, that is the path to nirvana, to nirvana? And so the Buddha was standing amidst his disciples, and he turned to the Venerable Sariputta and said, Sariputta, ordain the boy. Get the kid ordained. And so at this time there were not yet samaneras or young novices in the Buddhist order. It was only mature men who requested ordination. And so Rahula came. Well, the Buddha requested Sariputta to ordain Rahula. And in this way, Rahula became the first novice, the first samanera. And I believe this would have been perhaps the seventh, Rahula's seventh year. Is that correct? Then the discourse that is recorded here apparently takes place several years later, according to a note that I saw in Venerable Nyanamoli's book called The Life of the Buddha. The discourse took place when Rahula was 11 years old. And this will be a discourse on the beginning with the importance of truthful speech. And here, when the sutta begins, the Venerable Rahula was living at Ambalatika. This would be, have been some kind of grove or park in Rajagaha, not so far from the bamboo grove, apparently. And so when it was the evening time, then the Buddha rose from his meditation and went to see Rahula in this Ambalatika grove. And so Venerable Rahula, following the traditional etiquette, got his seat ready when he saw the Buddha coming, and he set out some water for washing the feet in a bowl. And then the Buddha sat down on the seat and he washed his feet with the water. And then he left a little bit of water in the bowl. And he said to Rahula, do you see this little bit of water left in the bowl? And Rahula said, yes, sir. And then the Buddha said, even so little, Rahula, is, here the word used is rikuship, or you could say the value of the religious life or spiritual life of one who is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. Here the Buddha is speaking to Rahula with reference to the state of a monk. But we could interpret this more broadly to taking it to mean the value of the religious or spiritual life of anybody who is seriously intent on following a way to true wisdom and liberation. Then the Buddha threw away that little bit of water that was left in the bowl. And then he asked Rahula, do you see how this little bit of water has been thrown away? Rahula says, yes. The Buddha says, so one who is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie has thrown away the value of his religious life. Then the Buddha turned the bowl upside down on the table. And he asked Rahula, do you see how this vessel has been turned upside down? And the Buddha says, Rahula says, yes. And the Buddha says, so one who is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie has turned his spiritual life upside down. Then the Buddha turned the bowl up the right side up and said, "Do you see how this water bowl is now empty and void?" And then the Buddha said, "In the same way, one who is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie has made his religious life empty and void." Then the Buddha gives, to illustrate this point further, he gives a long simile about an elephant in the service of a king, who at a certain point, after a certain amount of training, becomes so devoted to the king and so well disciplined in training that he is ready to give up even his life in the service of the king. And so the point is that there is now nothing that this royal elephant would not do. And then the Buddha draws the conclusion, in the same way, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I say, that one would not do. And so the Buddha then draws the conclusion that to Rahula, he says, "You should train thus, I will not utter a falsehood even as a joke." I have to admit I'm a little puzzled by the simile, because the simile apparently seems to be almost praising the elephant, like the elephant who has been trained to this extent, that he's ready to give up his life in the service of a king, is what one would call a really noble, perfectly trained, well-disciplined elephant. And yet the person who is ready to do anything, the person who is ready to do any evil, because he's not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, one would consider a very low, abject, despicable person. There seems to be a little element of discrepancy here. But anyway, we just have to accept the text the way it is. And I gave a rather long discourse on truthfulness in the meeting on Saturday, this past Saturday. And one point that comes to my mind, and this I brought up in the talk on Saturday, even though I don't want to seem to be contradicting the statement of the Buddha, but it seems to me that in actual life, that there sometimes come situations where there are clashes of different, say, moral vectors which bear on a situation and which tend to be pulling one in different directions. And so one never finds in the suttas cases where there's a conflict of moral, say, conflicts of moral imperatives. And it's always puzzled me why one doesn't find these really difficult ethical situations dealt with, these ambiguous ethical situations dealt with in the suttas. But I could conceive of cases where one is confronted with a choice, telling a falsehood which will protect the lives of innocent people. On the other hand, if one speaks the truth in that situation, it could lead to suffering and torment for innocent people. Perhaps the paradigm case would be that which took place in Europe during the time of the Nazis, when there were Christians who safeguarded Jewish people and kept them in their, gave them protection, refuge in their homes, in their shops, cellars and basements, attics. And when the Nazis would come around, they would inquire whether these people saw any Jews. And if the people who were protecting them were to speak truthfully and say yes, then the Nazis would inquire further, grab the Jewish people. They would search the home, grab the Jewish people, and kill them. So, I mean, there are such cases, but I think here we have to understand, as I explained on Saturday, the types of falsehoods which are extremely morally blameworthy, grave and blameworthy, those which are deliberately intended to harm somebody else, those which are intended to unfairly secure one's own disadvantage, one's own personal advantage in some way over others, or even those which are seemingly innocent, but still involve some blemish upon one's own character, such as telling a falsehood for the sake of a joke. Does anybody have any thoughts about this? It's an issue that I've thought about quite a bit. How different a single situation could imply, can be impinged upon by different implicit moral imperatives, and how one can resolve a conflict between moral imperatives arising out of a single situation. Yeah. In the back. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that is so, yeah. 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 So one has to say one feels some regret about telling any type of lie at all, even in a situation like that. But it seems that the one has to consider what is one going to regret. Is one going to regret having told what seems to be a slight falsehood in order to protect the lives of innocent people from terrible torment, torture, even death? Or is one going to speak the truth and maybe be able to pride oneself on one's fidelity to truth, while at the same time one recognizes that one has been responsible for the death of innocent people? Yeah, so in this case, it's not a case where one is actually intentionally taking the life of a person. So it could not be considered a case of killing or taking life. But it's just that as a consequence of one speaking the truth, innocent people will die. And so somebody who takes a very, very strict legalistic view of morality can say, in such a situation, I did nothing morally wrong. I did what was morally right because I spoke the truth. But it would seem that that would be a very narrow understanding of morality. Yes, Peter. That is a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that's a very good point. I think that's the best resolution of this kind of problem. Did you answer? Yeah, yeah. Because one still feels some regret or even a tinge of remorse about telling the lie. But one recognizes that in such a situation, one doesn't have any choice, any real choice. Yeah. Yeah, right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And anyway, according to the Buddhist understanding of karma, the decisive determinative factor in karma is the chaitanya, the volition, the intention. And so when one speaks a falsehood with the intention not really of misrepresenting reality, not wishing to harm anybody, not wishing to secure one's own selfish advantage in any way, but the intention is purely and simply to protect innocent people in a rather extreme situation, then I don't see that there could be any negative karmic impact of that action. Okay, I think that your point resolves this problem as best as is possible. Okay, now the Buddha goes on to draw further, to develop this theme further, giving a more broader view of the approach to action. First, again, he brings in a simile. This is a simile of a mirror. And he asks Rahula, what is... And you see, he's teaching a 10, 11-year-old boy. And so he has to use concrete similes, things that will make the ethical messages very vivid, picturesque, and that way they will make a deep impression on the mind. So first he's used the similes of the water, the examples of the water, then the simile of the royal elephant. Now he uses the purpose of a mirror. And so the purpose of a mirror is reflection. I think the Pali word here is pachavekana, to reflect. And so then the Buddha says, in the same way, an action done with the body should be done with repeated reflection. I think this text says, pachaveki va, pachaveki va, having reflected again and again. An action by speech should be done after repeated reflection. An action by mind should be done after repeated reflection. And now the Buddha is going to distinguish, in developing this theme, three phases with regard to any action. First, there is the period before engaging in the action. Then there is the period while one is engaged in the action. And then there is the period after one has completed the action. So from the standpoint of the agent, the three periods are when the action is future, something contemplated; when the action is present, something one is doing; then the third is when the action is past, something one has completed. And so before doing any action with body, speech, or mind, one should reflect, would this action that I wish to do lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both? And here you see the Buddha brings into balance concern with one's own welfare, concern with the welfare of others, and concern with the welfare of both. So even if the action has no direct impact upon others, but if the action will be in some way harmful to oneself, and harmful to oneself means harmful to one's own ethical and spiritual well-being, not harmful to oneself in material terms. So first one considers, what will be the impact of that action upon oneself and upon others? Then one considers, is it an unwholesome action? In this case, it seems when one is considering whether it's an unwholesome action, one is looking into the quality of the mind that is responsible for the action. In other words, one is looking at the mind to see whether the action will spring from an unwholesome mind or a wholesome state of mind. And then one looks at the action in terms of its karmic consequences. Is it an action that will have painful consequences, or an action that will have painful consequences or pleasant consequences? Actually, here we're just taking the case of the unwholesome action. So when you reflect, if you know that the action that you want to do, bodily action, would lead to one's own affliction, the affliction of others, or the affliction of both, that is, one considers the consequences, the likely consequences of the action, its impact upon others and oneself, then that is one criterion for refraining from that action. Then one looks at the psychological state from which the action springs. And if one sees that it's an unwholesome psychological state, an unwholesome mind, then one refrains from it. And one also knows that unwholesome actions will have painful karmic results. So that gives another incentive for refraining from the action. So I think we might put three criteria of reflection here. You know, when one evaluates the action from the psychological point of view, the first one evaluates the action from the point of view of its likely consequences, that requires a certain amount of foresight into the likely results of the action. Here, of course, one can't know everything, all the consequences in advance, but one can determine what will be the most likely consequences of a particular action. And we have to recognize that actions set off chain reactions. And while there are limits to the extent to which one can consider the consequences, but one has to take into account the most likely, the most visible, immediately visible consequences of one's action, its impact upon others, and also what will be its long-term impact upon oneself. For example, somebody, a poor man, might see a gold ornament in a shop, and he might be tempted to steal it, and he's quite certain in the situation that he can get away with it, that nobody will see him. And so he steals the ornament and gets away with it, and he's able to exchange the ornament for money, and he can become quite wealthy, successful. But that action has had some corrupting effect on his own mind, so that now he has become even more inclined to dishonest action in the future. And so one act of dishonesty will lead to other acts of dishonesty, until eventually he might become a major criminal, large-scale criminal, even if he gets into a high position in business or politics. Okay, so one considers the long-term consequences or impact of an action upon others and upon oneself. Then when one considers the action from the psychological viewpoint, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, here what one is looking for, what are the psychological factors that issue in this action? Particularly, one examines the mind to see whether the action is motivated by some greed, selfishness, self-seeking in any way, whether it's motivated by some aversion, resentment, desire for revenge, perhaps, or whether it's motivated by conceit, pride, jealousy, or whether it's motivated, on the other hand, by wholesome mental factors, by true generosity, concern for the welfare of others, by kindness, compassion. And then, generally, a person will not have direct insight into the karmic consequences of action, but by knowing, if one has the right view by which one understands the working of the law of karma and its results, one will realize that actions which are unwholesome, motivated by defilements, by defiled mental states, will bring about unwholesome karma, which will come back to oneself in the form of misery and suffering in the future. Whereas if one performs actions which spring from wholesome mental states, that these actions will generate wholesome karma, which will come back to oneself in the form of well-being and happiness. Okay, so then one uses these three criteria as standards for reflection on how one should act. And one does this now in the initial case before one starts the action. And then this will serve as a basis for determining whether to undertake the action or to refrain from that action. But then in paragraph 10, the Buddha takes the case where one might be engaged in an action, and in the midst of that action, one then reflects upon it, and one considers, does this action, one reflects upon it in the same way, exactly in the same way. And then if you know that the action brings affliction to oneself or others, that it's unwholesome, that it brings painful consequences, then even though one has started the action, then one should stop it, one should suspend it. But if you know that the action brings benefit to oneself and others, that it springs from a wholesome state of mind, that it has pleasant consequences, then you might continue with the action. Then in paragraph 11, the Buddha takes the case after the action has been completed. And in this case, one reflects upon the action when it's finished, and if one realizes that the action has been an unwholesome action, that is an action which leads to one's own affliction, the affliction of others, an unwholesome, that it springs from unwholesome mental factors, that it brings painful results, then one should, and here the Buddha is speaking to a monk, he's saying you should confess such a bodily action, reveal it, and lay it open to your teacher. Here the Buddha is referring to himself, or to your wise companions in the holy life. And then after you confess it, then you should undertake restraint in the future. But when you reflect, if you know that the action is a harmless or even beneficial action, then you can dwell happily and continue with your training day and night in wholesome states. And here the Buddha is referring to a principle which he has laid down for the monastic order. The monks have a code of conduct called the Vinaya. And if the monk breaks any of the rules of the Vinaya, then he should confess them to a fellow monk, those rules which can be amended by confession. In the case of lay life, my view would be that if one breaks one of the five precepts in a way which one considers to be quite serious, that one should find a fellow Dhamma friend to whom one can confess it, or even in the right circumstances to a monk or nun. We don't have in Buddhism a system of confession like the Catholic Church has, where you go to a priest, confess, then the priest will impose some penalty upon you, and then if you fulfill the penalty, then you become absolved from your sin. But this is mainly, it's a psychological technique of clearing oneself of the mental weight of having transgressed one of the important precepts. And the act of confession is something which lightens the mind of a burden. And so what one does is to confess the act, one makes a determination to refrain from that act in the future. One sort of fortifies one's resolution to keep the precept. And then one might also do some especially strong, wholesome action, beneficial action, as a way of counteracting the negative karma generated by the unwholesome action. Okay, now in the case of bodily action and the case of verbal action or speech, the pattern is exactly the same. But in the case of the mind or thoughts, there is a variation after one has thought an unwholesome thought with the mind. The Buddha says that one doesn't confess it to somebody else, since unwholesome thoughts arise naturally in the mind as long as the mind is not trained. And if one were to go about confessing unwholesome thoughts to somebody else, one would be making a nuisance out of oneself. But in the case of thoughts, unwholesome mental states, after one has given rise to any of them, then one feels a kind of repugnance towards those states. Not in the sense that one blames and criticizes oneself and inflicts a negative judgments upon oneself, but one feels regret and remorse for those thoughts, and one makes a determination to work more diligently, more energetically, to transform one's thoughts, change the patterns of one's action, of one's thinking. Okay, and then to give extra authority to this method of reflection that the Buddha has recommended to Rahula, the Buddha states that any ascetics and Brahmins in the past who purified their bodily, verbal, and mental actions all did so by repeatedly reflecting in that way. All ascetics and Brahmins in the future will purify their actions, will do so in the same way. And all ascetics and Brahmins in the present who purify their actions, all are doing so by repeatedly reflecting in the same way. And therefore, the training principle for Rahula is, we will purify our bodily, verbal, and mental actions by repeatedly reflecting upon them, just in that way. Unless that is the discourse. And if there are any questions or comments on this, it's a very short, simple discourse, but I lay down certain important guidelines to what we call mental, to moral and mental purification. How is... In English, the word venerable means one who has an advanced age. But the word venerable ayasma in Pali, just it's an honorific designation given to one who is ordained as a monk. Yeah. It's not only the elder monks. Any ordained monk is called venerable or ayasma, which also it means one who possesses life in the sense of long life. It's just somehow this honorific came to be applied to Buddhist monks. Yeah.
Is this,
I haven't, is this in the Agama?
Yeah.
You learned this, yeah. I'd never heard this before. Yeah.
That's why there was a reason. Buddha actually planned this
speech. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah. Rahula was lying.
Mm.
The thing will not utter a falsehood even as a joke. And he did it because he was childish.
Yeah.
And he wanted to kind of play joke on the people that came to see the Buddha. And yeah. He was the one who goes in and informs the Buddha someone came to see you. But he wouldn't do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
he told the people that came that, Buddha's not here. And then, so many people wanted to see the Buddha and couldn't see the Buddha. And so Buddha doesn't know it, and so time just
comes. I see, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It's Suki, yeah. 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 Falsehood, yeah. Yeah. Well, there is one of the precepts, is the fourth precept. Musa vada veramani sikapadang samadhyami. So I take the precept to abstain from speaking falsehood. But I have to say, as I explained on Saturday, that there are the different grades of falsehood, which have different moral weight depending upon the intention. And so the heavy karma accrues to somebody, the heaviest karma, who tells a deliberate lie which has a malicious motivation, in which the intention is to harm somebody else's status, reputation, to break up friendships, to harm somebody else. So, okay, the heavy moral weight also pertains to actions, to lies, which are intended in some dishonest way to secure one's own well-being, one's own advantage. For example, I'm working for a company, I see that there's a position about to open up a few steps above my own, and three or four people are competing for that position. So I want to get that position, so somebody else does some work, and I boast and say that I'm the one responsible for that. As a result, I get the higher position. Okay, I want to move on to another sutta now. And this sutta is not on the original list, but I think it ties in with the theme of right speech. And this is sutta number 58. It's the Abhaya Raja Kumara Sutta. And as background to the sutta, the Buddha had one monk disciple who was a member of the Buddha's own clan, the Shakya clan, whose name was Devadatta. And Devadatta had become very ambitious. He had acquired during his monk's life through his meditation practice, he acquired supernormal powers or iddhis, mystical or magical powers. And this acquisition of the magic powers made him very proud, self-satisfied. And his temperament was cold and ambitious, and he thought that he could replace the Buddha as head of the Sangha and become very famous and widely esteemed. And so he tried to persuade the Buddha, in the Buddha's old age, to turn over control of the order to himself, but the Buddha refused to do so. And then when the Buddha refused this request of Devadatta, then Devadatta befriended one of the kings, the king Ajatasattu, and then he won the favor of King Ajatasattu, and he got a lot of support from Ajatasattu. Again, he became very proud, even prouder, more arrogant than before. And he conceived such a bitter grudge and hostility against the Buddha that several times he tried to organize assassination attempts on the life of the Buddha. Persuading assassins to go and kill the Buddha. But each time the assassins came to the presence of the Buddha radiated his great loving kindness and compassion. And when the assassins came into the domain or the sphere of the Buddha's radiance, they were so impressed that they put down their weapons and bowed down to the Buddha and became ordained as Buddhist monks. And then he tried to kill the Buddha one time by getting an elephant, a royal elephant, drunk, and then releasing that elephant when the Buddha was walking through the town, so the elephant would come running towards the Buddha. But again, the Buddha radiated his loving kindness to the elephant, and so when the elephant came very close to the Buddha, the elephant bowed down and worshipped the Buddha. The elephant didn't ask to be ordained as a monk. And then another time, Devadatta, when the Buddha was walking back and forth at the foot of a mountain, Devadatta pushed a heavy stone down the mountain in the hope that it would hit the Buddha and kill him. But the stone was deflected by another stone which had fallen just at that occasion, and a splint broke off from that falling stone, and the splint hit the Buddha's foot and injured the Buddha. And then the Buddha warned Devadatta that as a result of his heavy karma, that he would be reborn in a lower realm, in the hell realm. And so that is the background for this sutta. And the sutta is initiated by another rival of the Buddha, not within his own order, but the head of one of the rival communities, spiritual communities. This is the order of the Jain, which is headed by a teacher called, in the Buddhist text, Nigantha Nataputta. He is known to history as Mahavira. And I have to say exactly how this background story, well, it could have come to the knowledge of the Buddha. This story could have come to the knowledge of the Buddha. Okay, anyway, Nigantha Nataputta persuades one of his disciples, the prince named Abhaya, to go to the Buddha and try to refute his doctrine by putting the Buddha in a quandary, by exposing him to a dilemma that he won't be able to answer. And the dilemma is this. The prince is to ask the Buddha whether he would ever utter speech that would be disagreeable to others. And the underlying assumption here is that somebody who is truly enlightened would never speak anything that's disagreeable to others. That's the assumption of Nigantha Nataputta, not the assumption of the Buddha. And so Nigantha Nataputta says that when the Buddha is asked this question, he could answer in either of two ways. If he says that he does utter speech which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, then this implies that his conduct is not any different from that of an ordinary worldling, a common person. Because ordinary person too will utter speech which is disagreeable to others. But if the Buddha says that he doesn't utter any speech that's disagreeable to others, then you could pin him down as a liar. Because you just present him with the statement that he spoke to Devadatta, his ambitious cousin. He told Devadatta that you are destined for the states of misery, destined to stay in hell, to be reborn in hell, and to stay there for an aeon. And then when Devadatta heard that, he was angry and upset. So Nigantha Nataputta thinks that when the Buddha is presented with this dilemma, he will be trapped and won't be able to reply. It will be a completely embarrassing situation for him. Now he uses a simile that it's just as if an iron spoke had gotten stuck in a man's throat. On the one hand, he wouldn't be able to swallow it down, or he wouldn't be able to spit it out, or he wouldn't be able to swallow it down. And so when the ascetic Gotama is given this dilemma, this two-pronged question, he won't be able either to throw it up to get rid of it because he's been asked the question, and he won't be able to gulp it down, he won't be able to give a satisfactory answer to it. He'll be trapped. And so it seems Prince Abhaya, from the start, he has some regrets about being assigned this mission, since the text says that he went to the Buddha, paid homage to him, then when he sat down, he looked at the sun and thought, it's now too late in the day to try to refute the Buddha right here and now. But he still wanted to fulfill the mission, so he thought he would do it the next day. This is like following the principle of putting off for tomorrow what you don't want to do today. And so he invited the Buddha and some other monks to come to his palace the next day for a meal. Then the Buddha arrives, and after the Buddha finishes his meal, Then Prince Abhaya comes up to him and poses him that question. Here we're in paragraph 6. Would a Tathagata utter such speech as would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others? Then the Buddha gives an evasive but appropriate answer to that. He says, there is no one-sided answer to this, Prince. And at that point, as soon as the Buddha says that, the Prince Abhaya realizes, now the Niguntas have lost in this, and he says that out loud. And so then the Buddha asks, what do you mean by this? And Prince Abhaya reports his conversation with Niguntha Nataputta. Then the Buddha gives one a simile to point out the principle that underlies his approach to speech. And he takes a simile which will be very meaningful to, as he always does, a simile which will be very meaningful to the person that he's addressing. The prince would have had a little child, maybe one who's being groomed to succeed him as prince. And so the Buddha says, you have a little child. And if, when he was in charge of a nurse, this child were to take a stick or pebble and put it in its mouth and then try to swallow that stick or pebble, and it got stuck in the mouth of the child. So he asked the prince, what would you do in such a situation? And the prince says, I would try to take it out, and if I couldn't take it out at once, then I would put my finger into the child's mouth, even push the finger down the throat, and pull out that stick or pebble, even if it is painful to the child and draws blood. And what is the reason for that? Because I have compassion for the child. And so now the Buddha explains what type of speech he himself will utter. And this I like to do in a schematic way. This was the chart that I was trying to type, but my computer was being uncooperative.
So we take different combinations of factors involved in speech.
Can you follow the sequence? Anyway, I will go through and get... Okay, the first is the case where the speech the Tathagata, the Buddha, knows to be untrue. It's false speech. Yeah, I wrote the first one. It's too big, so it took up too much space. It's false, the speech is false, it's not beneficial or even harmful to others, and then it's disagreeable to others. In this case, the Buddha does not utter such speech. And here what counts against the speech is not the fact that it's disagreeable, but rather the fact that it's false and unbeneficial. So on those two counts, the Buddha doesn't utter that speech. In the second case, the speech which is true, but it's unbeneficial and disagreeable to others. In this case, the Buddha does not utter it. The reason why he doesn't utter it is that it is not because it's disagreeable, but because it's without any benefit to others. In the third case, we have speech which is true, which is beneficial, and disagreeable to others. And this is the speech that the Buddha will utter at the appropriate time. And the reason why the Buddha will utter this speech is because the speech is true. First of all, one factor is that it's true. The second is that it's beneficial, maybe even necessary for the well-being of others. And the fact that it is disagreeable to others, that is not the concern of the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha has compassion for the others, but sometimes in order to correct people who are stubborn, obstinate, undisciplined, unwieldy, unruly, one has to speak to them sternly, with tough words. And the Buddha does this numerous times in the suttas. Especially in the Vinaya Pitaka, you have many, many cases where there are monks who behave in ways inappropriate for renunciates. There's a famous group of monks called the monks of the group of six, Chabagya Bhikkhus. They do everything considered wrong, usually not serious things, but like they like to decorate their robes with polka dots, or wear, if the Buddha allows the monks to wear slippers, they like to, well, I shouldn't, I think my slippers might be in that category. But they like to wear brightly colored slippers. When the Buddha says that the monks can use umbrellas in the time of rain, then they put decorative dragons and lions and tigers on their umbrellas. And so the Buddha constantly has to call them up and admonish them and urge them to change their behavior. And we see sometimes even in the suttas, we'll see in some of the suttas that will be coming up soon, the Buddha has to call monks to his presence and speak to them. Particularly there are some cases of monks who advocate views which are very contrary to the teachings of the Buddha. Then the Buddha will call those monks to his presence, and I can't say that he scolds them, but he speaks very, very sternly to them. And that is not because the Buddha has any animosity towards these individuals, but because first he sees that it's in the long-range benefit of those individuals that they be spoken to quite sternly and admonished to change their ways. And also it's for protecting his teaching, the long life of his dispensation. Okay, so in this case, the Buddha will speak what is true, beneficial, and disagreeable to others, and he will utter such speech at the right time. That is, generally, he will not call the individual to his presence when the individual, the person, is maybe involved with some important business, maybe when the person is taking a meal or bathing. And generally, he won't speak to the person in front of a large group of... He won't speak to a monk in front of a large group of lay people, since that would embarrass the monk in front of the lay community. But he'll call the monk to his presence, either alone or with some other monks around. And if the individual feels upset and disturbed by the Buddha's speech, that is just all the more reason for him to change his behavior. Okay, so that is one side of the Buddha's speech. The other side, now we come to speech which is false. Now I'm up to four. The speech which is false, unbeneficial, and agreeable to others. This speech, even though it's agreeable to others, people like to hear it. The entertaining stories, good jokes, flattery. But if it's false and without any benefit, then the Buddha won't speak it. And the reason he doesn't speak it is because it's false and unbeneficial. Then there is speech which is true and unbeneficial, but agreeable to others. And even though this speech is true and agreeable, but the factor that blocks it out is the second, that it's unbeneficial. And so this speech the Buddha does not utter. And then there is speech which is true, beneficial, and agreeable to others. And this speech, too, the Buddha will utter at the proper time. And so the key factors in the Buddha's speech, the two key factors are that the statements will always be true and they will always be beneficial. If the statement is true but unbeneficial, the Buddha won't speak it. And then one case that the sutta doesn't take, which is quite interesting, the case where a statement might be false but beneficial to others. And that case is not considered at all. It seems perhaps that the Buddha or the compilers of the suttas seem to consider that any statement that is false is incapable of being beneficial. Excuse me?
In the long run.
In the long run, yeah. Yeah. That is in the Lotus Sutra, and that is, I mean, it's an attempt to sort of justify the Lotus Sutra. But one doesn't find any instances like this in the Pali Sutras, where the Buddha will say something which is false in order to, false with the idea that it has some long-term benefit.
Yeah. So he would talk about something a certain practitioner has done.
Yeah.
And it was very diligent.
Yeah.
A certain person was very diligent, and but he would not say his name.
Yeah.
So theoretically speaking, that's not completely. He would say, "My friend, monk, did so such and such." But in fact, we found out later that it was himself. But what he said actually proved to be very beneficial.
Yeah.
So that is called yet very beneficial at the same time very agreeable.
Mm.
Why wouldn't that be uttered?
I don't know if that is actually false. One could say that one is one's own friend. No? Yeah. Yeah. Tathagata. Yeah. Anyway, I just mentioned this as an interesting case, which is not dealt with in this. Actually, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What rabbit? That was definitely false.
No, that was a way of not speaking, uttering a false statement, but allowing the eagle to draw its own conclusions.
It was evasive.
Yeah. Right. The Buddha works a feat of psychic power so that Yasa, the young man, remains invisible to his father. And then the Buddha engages the father in a talk on Dhamma so that the father's mind gets engaged, absorbed in the talk of the Buddha, and doesn't think about his son anymore. Then, at the end of the Buddha's conversation with the father becomes a stream enterer, Sotapanna. And then the Buddha says, if you were to see Yasa now and to realize that he too has attained the state, would you want him to come back to the household life? And then the father says, no, not necessary. No, I wouldn't want him to come back. Then the Buddha terminates that feat of psychic power, so that Yasa reappears to the father, and that's the way. So there's a difference, say, in the case of the Jataka story, the Buddha doesn't speak, or the Bodhisattva doesn't speak an actual falsehood, but he just, by asking a question, he evades giving a false answer. He escapes having to give either a true answer or a false answer. Yeah. Actually, that's a good, and still, yeah, that's a good point. A good point, yeah. There's still the intention to mislead. Yeah. But also, I have to say, the intention is also to protect an innocent being. Yeah. 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 Peter, did you have that? Yeah. Yeah, but the ale wrigglers are the ones who evade giving a definite answer, either because they don't know it, they don't really understand the problem in depth, or they want to appear clever by giving sophistical arguments. But the Buddha doesn't give answers on those questions because, you say, they lie beyond the range of comprehension by the ordinary undeveloped mind. Okay, let us just finish up. Okay, so the two main points that what determine the speech of the Buddha is the commitment to truth, the commitment to benefit others. Then the Buddha will sometimes speak what is disagreeable and sometimes what is agreeable. His aim is always benevolent, always wishing to help others. But the response depends upon the listener. And sometimes if the listener gets upset and doesn't get benefited by the Buddha's reply, then it's the fault of the listener. Okay, then just to conclude the sutta, the prince comes up with another question, whether when others, inquirers, come to the Buddha and formulate a question and then go to the Buddha and pose it, has the Buddha already sort of prepared his answers to these questions by thinking that if they come up and ask me such and such a question, then I will answer it in this way. If they ask me a different question, then I will reply in that way. In other words, does he have to do the things that I have to do when I'm preparing a lecture? I'll cover these points, and what if they ask me about that? And maybe then I should reply in this way, and if they ask me this, oh, then I'm in a real dilemma. Well, does the answer just occur to the Tathagata on the spot? Then the Buddha gives a counterexample to the prince. He says the prince is known to be very skilled in the parts of a chariot. So if people come up to the prince and ask him about what is this part of a chariot? What function does it perform? Do you have to plan your answers in advance, or do you know the answers immediately? Like when somebody who's skilled with computers, does he have to think in advance, if somebody meets this problem, then I'll solve it in that way? If somebody has this problem with the computer, then I'll solve it in that way? Or is the person, when anybody comes up with a problem with the computer, immediately he knows how to solve it? Like Dao Ming here, so many times my computer doesn't function properly, then I just go to him and say, Dao Ming, come and look at my computer. And he immediately, 2 seconds, he has it fixed. But he hasn't been sitting there in his room pondering, what if that happens to Fonte's computer? What if this happens? Okay, so the prince answers that he can answer all of these questions regarding the parts of the chariot right on the spot. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, when other scholars and sages come to me and ask me questions, then I can answer them right on the spot. Because I have fully penetrated, here's the expression used, is that element of things, that Dhamma Dhatu, that element or realm of the Dhammas, through the full penetration of which the answer occurs to the Tathagata on the spot. And I think the commentary the commentary says that what is meant by the Dhamma Dhatu there is the Sabhanyuta Jnana, the knowledge of omniscience. That because the Buddha has penetrated a Buddha's omniscient knowledge, he can answer all questions of all inquiries. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta. Any questions or comments just before we conclude? Okay, then today we will do. Did you distribute that? Everybody has gotten a copy of the dedication of merit sheet. So we do the sharing of the merit. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata ca mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca mehi padang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sattha anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. I'll recite the dedication in English in case the protective deities around here know English rather than Pali. Whatever great powerful deities and spirits there are in space or around the earth, may they rejoice in the merit of this discourse and for a long time protect the dispensation or the teaching of the Buddha. And the second verse, may they for a long time protect the exposition of the teaching. Then for a long time, may they protect myself and others. Then the second three verses, to whatever extent we have acquired merit, an accumulation of merit by teaching and listening to the Dhamma, may all of the devas or deities rejoice in that merit and achieve all success. The second verse, may all the harmful spirits rejoice in that merit and achieve all success. And the third verse, may all sentient beings rejoice in that merit and achieve all success.